hold on, recording.
Oh, yeah, you might want to press the fucking record button, bro.
I did. The program was lagging. All right. But it's not now. Welcome to the MacGuffin. I'm Alex. And with me on the other side is my always supportive podcast partner, James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We recently did... we returned to the world of video podcasts. Kind of, we did a short 8-minute thing on the end of The Graduate, which is basically our version of doing director's commentary without making movies. And we've also recently talked about Clueless, Casablanca, Furious 7. So a real mix of things at the website right now. Also follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Men. Double also, I have written a book. It is in the process of about to be being edited. If you know anything about publishing, because I know a lot of people listen to this in various places, and I don't really know who our listenership is, but if you have any information about self-publishing or something, somebody that you know has had success doing something with publishing, feel free to hit me up on Twitter at The MacGuffinmen. But yes, we are talking about a movie today that I enjoyed, and we will get to the theme song and come back and talk about that movie.
Welcome to The MacGuffinmen. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yep.
Ready to go.
I'm so ready.
We are talking about It Follows.
Yes. Ooh, you said the title first this time.
I did. I'm trying to keep you on your toes.
None
like a horror movie.
Robert David Mitchell's?
David Robert Mitchell.
Yeah.
Just one Mitchell. It's not pluralized.
Too many first names. yes, his follow-up to another movie you enjoyed, The Myth of the American Sleepover.
That is correct. Which is basically a title made by a focus group trying to come up with a title for a movie I would like.
Yes, and this is dealing with some of the same themes of adolescence and teenage years, but is significantly different in tone.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've kind of... already stated that you did enjoy this movie?
Yes, I did. I like it. It's good times.
What'd you like about it?
I think it's really well directed. It's obviously a very pretty movie. It's one of those movies that always makes me really happy when something that is obviously shot on a low budget, it still doesn't shoot everything handheld. They still think, we don't have money, but that doesn't mean we don't have a tripod, you know, and they can still sort of compose shots with ideas behind them. And I really like that. And I think the most prominent ones are, the most prominent one is probably the first shot of the movie with the long shot from the middle of the street that just pans and zooms over the course of about a minute until the character drives out of frame. I thought it was really well directed, and I'm kind of conflicted about this movie because I think this movie is really on the line of not saying enough and expecting me to do all the legwork, which I'm happy to do, but I feel like there's a lack of commitment in this movie to any specific idea that kind of hurts it in the long run. Like, I think it can be about a lot of things, but I don't think there's anything that really has the upper hand, and I think that's kind of a problem with this movie. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I think that people, just from the trailer or from a very brief description of this movie, it's easy to say it's just a metaphor for sexually transmitted diseases or maybe a specific one. I've seen some people talk about how it's an allegory for AIDS and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think it lends itself really well to some of those kind of really on the nose readings about like a sexually transmitted disease, because I mean, this really is a sexually transmitted like horror. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. the actual threat is very explicitly stated, like transmitted by having sex with people. So I think there's something on the surface that is very, very easy to read in this movie. But I also think that it's about a lot of different things as well. And it's about some things that are tied up with STD. know, losing your virginity. It's about coming of age. It's about, you know, the transition into adulthood and things like that.
That's the part I find really interesting, the transition into adulthood. But anyways, yeah. Continue.
Well, no, I think all that's there. And I think to look at this movie and, you know, as I said, in a one sentence synopsis of this movie, you can pretty much guess a very, what I think is a strong reading of this movie. But I think that there's a lot more to this movie. I think that you can look at a lot of different things. And yeah, some of them are related. But I think to make it so cut and dry to say that this is definitely what it's about, I think is doing yourself a disservice and not getting enough credit to the movie. Because it does really put a lot of ideas out there and let you play with them.
But yeah, for sure. I'm certainly not saying anything opposite to that.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear you say that it doesn't say enough, though, because you're usually taking the side of ambiguity and leaving a lot to the viewer.
Well, here's the... Okay. And yeah, I mean, I still haven't figured this movie out. Because, like you said, there are a lot of things to read into this movie, and I like a lot of them. And I think it's just... Maybe there's something about... I don't know. I just haven't I saw this in like the middle of March and I still haven't come to what I think about it. Or why this bothers me. And, maybe this podcast will help as a sort of, a way for me to get through my struggles here. But yeah, I definitely like this movie a lot. It feels like it's either slightly dumber than I think it is and expects me to make it better by being a smart person and willing to be thoughtful about this movie that's clearly well put together. Or it's way ahead of me and I just still need to catch up, you know?
Yeah, I that does make sense to me. And I think maybe part of that is, one, and this is to a lesser degree what I think is bothering you, but the ambiguous ending, I think, just kind of leaves you like you don't get it all. Even if you like ambiguous endings, sometimes you just feel like you don't understand 100% of something if you can't say this led to that and now we're here and that's it. And I know that kind of stuff doesn't bug you, but I think some people kind of get left with that taste in their mouth that maybe this movie doesn't have itself figured out.
Yeah, but the again, I love the ending of this movie. So it's just I don't know. It's just so difficult for me to figure it out.
Well, that's why I was saying that's my first point that applies less to you than I think most people who would see this movie. My second larger point, I think, is that, you know, if you want to hear me talk about Scream for 4 hours, we have the podcast to do it. But I will talk about Scream very briefly here because I think it's a different kind of horror movie where Scream seems to exist inside a sitcom. You know, like there are these horrible, violent elements to it, but it seems like that is the outlier. And that at the end of the Scream movies, except for the fact that they always leave them open for sequels, it seems like we're going to get back to that place. Like we are going, now that, you know, this menace, this ghost face menace has been taken care of, let's go back to our world. Let's go back to 90210 world where everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And everything's peaceful. And this problem has been resolved, where I don't think that there's any ever hope of getting back to anything in this movie, even with the it killed, even with anything, even before things start really going poorly in this movie and just the atmosphere that's created throughout this movie, there isn't that like Garden of Eden to go back to at any point in this movie. It's such an unsettling movie that I think that even if we get past the character conflicts and struggles, it's not like we're done. You know what I mean? Like it's just the way that this movie's put together, the atmospheric nature of it, and just, you know, the grim nature of Detroit and all these things. Like, I just don't think that you ever get the feeling that everything's great, but then this bad thing came up, and then we overcome this bad thing, and we're back to the great place. There's nothing about this movie that ever makes you feel like things are going to be okay, because they were never okay to begin with. And maybe if they were okay, it was okay in the sense that you were a child at one point and you've lost your innocence. And if you come to terms with that, it doesn't solve the problem. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and that's a big reason why I like the ending of this movie is because, you know, we get that shot of Paul and Jay walking together hand in hand, both wearing white and denim coats. They're just walking together and there's somebody following them in the middle of the sidewalk a bit further back. But the thing I like so much about that setup is that, one, just sort of the setup of the shot, it's two people in their late teenage years walking hand in hand down the sidewalk of a suburb. It's just very, it's a teen movie shot, so obviously I'm into it. They, like, I think by them wearing white, I think it's supposed to mean that they sort of think that they're safe and they're pure again. Like, they have defeated this thing. It has turned into a giant cloud of blood in the pool and it is gone. They are safe now. They are together and they are happy. And the one thing that they don't realize about their life for the rest of their life is that once something horrible happens to you, it stays with you the whole time, until you die, basically. Like, it's just this thing that will continually follow you and will pop up from time to time. And it'll just, you know, even if it's just something like a particular sadness that follows you, you know, like somebody broke your heart once or whatever, and it just never leaves and is always kind of there, but sometimes it is able to catch up to you closer. You know, sometimes you're in a place with only one exit, and and that's the thing I like about that ending, you know?
Yeah, but I think we need to talk about the use of white in this movie, because I think white often means like pure and clean and in the clear, and I don't think that's what it is in this movie. The people dressed in white are usually the people who are doing the hunting, and even at the end, yeah, they're both wearing white, but they're both wearing very dark coats and boots or pants or leggings or something. Like, it's not just white. I think it's that scene, it has so many dualities in it. They're wearing black and white. We have an old man raking leaves, and we have the sound of, we have old and young, and then they're caught in between. And, you know, I'm sure it'll come up, but just the use of autumn in this movie, it's, you know, such a transitional period.
Yep.
And, you know, we have the old man raking up leaves, which is like this old man, you know, stating that autumn's over and he's past it, and like he pretty much is kind of, he's not death at that point, he's not the new it or anything, but he is a sign of, you know, the period after the period what they're in right now, maybe far after, but definitely after. And then you know, the movie ends with kind of the sound of children laughter, and so all on screen there we have like this visual of this old man representing death, we have these young children, this innocence, this play, you know, spring, youth. And then we have these people who are very much in the middle. And nothing is resolved. It's just, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Nothing's resolved. It's just kind of like a tableau of the three phases. And they are still very much uncomfortable. Like, they don't look super pleased. They looked, you know, a bit relieved that they're not constantly being hunted anymore. But as you said, you never get past those things. Those bad things that happen to you never leave you just because they've been part of your experience. And so, you know, as I said, there's more than the reading of looking at this as sex and make this movie all about sex or sexually transmitted diseases or things like that. But I think this is, I don't know, them kind of being with each other, but not necessarily in the clear or not necessarily 100% happy with each other is kind of, you know, that period in your life. Just do the best you can. Find someone you care about. You know, it's. I think the scene when they have sex, Paul and Jamie, is kind of bittersweet. Seems to be the first time she's having sex with someone during the movie, kind of on her own terms since Hugh, and we saw how that worked out. You know, and I think it's like, hey, this isn't perfect, but spend time or have sex if that's what you want to go for, like with people for the right reasons, and do your best and stick together with people who you think are going to help you, and, you know, kind of be who you are on your own terms and let people in if they're the right people. But don't do these kinds of things. Don't force yourself to grow up. Don't try to be someone else just to try to be someone else. You know what I mean? I think it's a pretty unsettling ending, but it's not terribly tragic and it's not terribly uplifting. And I think that's adolescence.
Yeah, exactly.
You saw them being followed by the person in the back there?
Oh, yeah, of course.
What's do you have any particular read on that, or?
Yeah, it's just what I was saying, that pretty much no matter where you go, even if you think you're in this kind of this shot that could be seen as a very sort of safe thing, like walking down the street with somebody that may or may not be your girlfriend holding their hand, or vice versa. And you know, there's still just the sadness behind you. It's just it will always trail behind you, even if you move on to a new phase of your life, you know.
Right. Did you have any particular reading on the different forms that it takes throughout this movie?
Well, I think there's more to those than I looked into. The last, like the pool one, is her dad. It's Jay's dad, right?
That's my understanding.
Yes. Because it seems pretty clear to me, because she's looking at a picture afterwards and it seems like it's the exact same person in that picture. And it's very clearly like a family portrait.
And her sister Kelly asks what it looks like and she doesn't want to say.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the tip off to be like, hey, well, you should probably look more at this person than maybe the other ones. Judging by the way that this movie is put together, every it has some sort of significance. I didn't really hit the message boards to find out though.
you don't have to. You can just make your own ideas instead of stealing other people's. Like,
yeah, exactly. I guess I don't have much of a reading. I just assume that there is some sort of lingering effect that this person would have on the person that it killed, like, or kills or is following. Like, the obvious one is when fake Will Friedle gets killed by his mom. He probably just doesn't, like, I don't know, he's got some issues with his mom, and his mom is what kills him, you know, or those issues with his mom are what personify into it, and then it kills him, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's another the part of his mother there. I think that's another thing that there are so many like charged images in this movie, like so many things to be read into, like, oh, someone just had sex with their mom and then died. Any Freudian issues you want to plug in here? Now is the time. Like, yeah. There's just so, I think there's a couple moments like that, you can't draw like one consistent through line and like that says, this is my reading of this movie and this is how every single part falls into it. Mm-hmm. There's just so many things like that that I think lend themselves to, you know, different interpretations, which adds to the rewatchability of a movie and to the amount of time you can spend thinking about it and still find it interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
We should talk about the Peanuts cartoon style of parenting in this movie, or this entire world that they're in.
Yeah. Well, I was reading
not a ton of parents.
No. And I was reading an interview with David Robert Mitchell, and he specifically said they wanted to avoid the influence of the adult world. And I found that interesting because I thought they were just sort of avoiding parents because to sort of show these kids just be on their own. And I guess that's exactly what it means. But yeah, not a lot of model parenting in this movie. An absentee father. I forget if they have an explanation for where their father is. But I know he's not a part of the family anymore. And it seems like, I forget, I'm going to keep calling him fake Will Friedle until I find out his name, but Greg? Yeah. Yes. It seems like his father, I don't know if his father's explained, but he's not around.
He's never seen. And then his mom, he explains his mom won't notice that he's gone.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing with Jay's mom is that, she doesn't notice when they're gone. She will drink herself to sleep. It seems like quite frequently, if not always. She will pour Bailey's in her coffee.
Yeah.
So yeah, not you know, the most observant parents in the world, you know.
Yeah.
But it seems like they haven't. It's not like they were without their lessons they never gave their kids lessons as a child or something. It seems like maybe something has turned with time, but certainly not. Not the parents from Leave It to Beaver or something.
Yeah. I guess there's a theory that Jamie's dad died, and that turned his mom to alcoholism, and why it's so important when he shows up at the end.
Okay.
Yeah, but I mean, again, this movie is subtle in a lot of ways. Like, her drinking is, you know what I mean? Like,
sorry, you cut out?
Her drinking's pretty understated. Like, you have to look in the background to see her drinking. It's not like she's throwing bottles at all the kids.
No, exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's pretty subtle when she does drink. She drinks frequently, but it's not that stereotypical alcoholic abusive parent.
Yeah, they do make it pretty clear with the shot of her. We see her feet, like she's lying down on her bed, and we dolly out of the room. And it's made very clear that there is a bottle of wine on the stand next to her bed, or like the dresser that's in her room, with a recently put out cigarette, you know. So that one, that's the least subtle shot, you know. But yes, you are 100% right. There is no screaming at their children while hucking bottles of bourbon across the room.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not even just parents, but you know, when the cops speak to them, you never see, like, you don't really see cops' faces. You don't. Mm-hmm. Nurses and doctors and things like that. Like, even when you have to have an adult in this story, they're not fleshed out at all. And I don't think that's just poor characterization. I think it's kind of teenage dream world. And I don't mean paradise. I just mean, like, it's this weird teenage existence, like the setting that's created for this movie, the atmosphere. Parents just aren't a part of it. Like, they don't go to parents for help. The parents don't really intervene that much. They don't go to adults for help. They don't go to institutions. You know, the teacher reads a while with some, you know, thematic readings to the movie, but we don't even get a single shot of her face. Like, they're in this movie, adults, but it's very, very much on the fringe, and only ever when it's like a plot device or something to move the plot forward, like Hugh's mother or something like that. It's a very like teenage centric world.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But do you know what I mean by kind of the weird atmosphere of this movie? Like, it's
100%.
It's so hard to place so much of this movie. Like, TV shows appear to stop being made in like the 50s. There's like the period music. I mean, the music seems to be from like the 70s, 80s period.
Yeah, it's very John Carpenter music.
Yeah, 100%. And like the theater they're in there is weird. But then you see, you know, like touchscreen e-readers and things like that. What do you make of kind of this timelessness? I don't know, I'd say kind of dream world that they create for this movie.
Well, before I get to that, I learned something today that I feel like kind of ties into what we're talking about. They go to see Charade, right? So this is a very low budget movie. I don't know if you know much about the history of Charade, but when it was released, Universal didn't properly file its copyright claim. So once it was released, Charade was a public domain, and has remained so. Like, the only stipulation is if you're listening to the music outside of the context of the movie, then that's copyrighted. But if you're talking about the movie, it's public domain. So I think that's the reason they chose Charade as the movie for that scene, just because it didn't cost them anything. And it's a very low budget movie. But yeah. I thought that was really funny. To go with the timelessness factor that you're speaking about. I think part of that is to sort of tie into to sort of accentuate the point that they don't want this movie to appear to be about modern kids. They want or modern teenagers, modern youth, they want it to be about youth, you know, or something that that never changes. They want to give it this, it just wants to be a statement on what it is to be human more than what it is to be human right now, or human in 1980, or human in 1962, or whenever this movie could conceivably exist. I think it's partially just so to sort of increase the universality of it. And I think that's pretty much all I've got.
Yeah. I'd be curious to see how it ages.
I think the weird thing you mentioned, the music, synths just tend to not age particularly well as music. Like, they always sound like a product of their time because they're digital. And so a synth from 1980 just sounds like a synth from 1980 because it's used with the materials for that time, right? Whereas with most instruments, it's more of a imperceptible thing. But yeah, I think this movie will age well.
Yeah. So what else?
Sorry.
no, it's not you mishearing. It's me not being able to speak.
Okay.
what else did you? Any other takeaways about the visuals on this movie?
It's gorgeous. Like, I guess the design of these shots, the spinning shots, are very nice.
I mean, 360 shots are, I think, a good fit for a lot of horror movies, but I think this one particularly well, just because having no idea about the nature of this thing, where it's going to come from. And I think, I mean, the idea that they were going to use them, I think, is good. And I think that it was just executed very well when they did decide to do it.
Oh, absolutely. And to what you were saying, it's like you have to always be able to look 360 degrees kind of at all times because you never know where it is, right?
Yeah.
And it's also, that's just a very difficult thing to pull off because, you know, I would imagine the setup of that shot is the camera with the camera operator and the director behind them, and they're just shuffling their feet behind as they're panning the camera. And there's also zooms in a lot of those shots too, which add some complexity. Add some visual complexity and also add some trickiness to the actual shot setup. But there are other shots throughout the movie that I think are just the sign of somebody that knows what they are doing. And there's a really good one early in the movie where it's just before we first get introduced to Jay. It's leading into her scene in the pool, their backyard pool at the end. Mm-hmm. The camera, it's a tracking shot from out front of their house along the side into the backyard where we join up with Jay. But at the beginning of that shot, you can see Paul knocking on the door, trying to get let in and not being let into the house. And I thought that was really nice. And then because at the end, when Jay and Paul end up having sex, they are together in what I think is that house, that same house, unless they're at Paul's house. But I'm judging by the way the rest of the movie has worked, they're at Jay's. And the camera shows them from inside the house together looking out. And I thought that was a really interesting pairing of shots, especially since one comes so close to the beginning and one comes so close to the end.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just gorgeous composition throughout the movie. And there's when Paul is sitting on his beach chair by the water, the line of his chair, even though it's on an angle, matches up with or runs parallel to the line of the horizon of the water, like, which is just a really tricky thing to do, but that they took time to do it, you know. And there's little things that where they fucked up too, where the shutter speed on Eric in that same, or sorry, Greg on that same, in that same scene is a little messed up, I think, just to match in with the lighting. But you know, pretty mild complaints given the rest of the movie.
Yeah. What did you make of those? I think there's three of them, kind of, I don't know, like bird's eye view shots, like her putting the blades of grass on her leg. Thistle, as she's kind of telling that story about what she thought sex would be like when she was younger, and or what teenage years would be like when she was younger.
Yeah, there's more than three of them, actually. There are at least five. Maybe six. I just have "in pool" written as my first note under Jay's hands.
Yeah, there's I think maybe the ant on her arm.
Oh, yes, that's exactly it. Yeah, so there are six. And I also like the way that this movie establishes Jay's perspective in that pool scene. Like, we kind of join her in the backyard, and then we get a couple like really subtle POV shots of her where they're kind of like the frame is floating because it's handheld, but it's still very smooth. Like, it's not like jagged handheld. Like, and it's sort of to tell us that we are now seeing what Jay sees, and this is the perspective that we have. And I thought that was an interesting way to introduce that. But yeah, you said in the car where she's touching flowers, when she's talking to the cops, we get a shot of her hands on her knees.
Oh yeah.
Did you mention the ice cream?
No.
When she's eating ice cream, there's one of those. And, at the very end, I think she puts her hand in the pool. The pool at the end. I think what that is sort of it shows somebody not going far away from the world they know. Like, they're not going far away from what's in front of their eyes, because we're seeing what's in front of her eyes, which is her knees or her hands, whatever. And yeah. It's just her, like, she's never doing anything particularly quickly. It's always very slow movements, and it's just sort of like, it's a feeling out process. You know, she's sort of just touching this thing to see what it is like, or to see how she can manipulate it in the case of the ice cream a little bit. Or with, when she's got her hands on her knees, she's touching her knees because there's just nothing else to like grab onto that she feels safe around right now. Other than like herself, like she's the only person she trusts right now. Because she just dealt with a lot of broken trust. And yeah, I think it is. It ties into that whole growing up sort of theme that runs throughout this movie. And it's about doing so slowly and starting to experience the world slowly. And yeah, I think that's pretty much the meaning of those shots.
Okay. Yeah. You know? Okay, good. I'm glad. Because I really didn't like, they stand out so much that, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, there's very little motion. It's always, I mean, I think about the, her hands, as you said, or the ice cream. It's these very symmetrical shots with nobody's face, and like, it's just a beat where you kind of get a moment to breathe and put yourself in her position. And I think, yeah, your reading of that definitely makes makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm.
Oh, the camera attached to the wheelchair. I just want to point out that
I loved
that was wonderful.
So much.
Yeah.
Oh, that was so good, and like, I loved that. Like, they really kind of ease you into it. Like, she's there and she's kind of shaking. And yeah. I wasn't even sure if what I saw was really happening. I'm like, did the camera move a little bit there? Like, yeah. When she's kind of just struggling to get out as soon as Jehu shows up.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of moves a bit. But then it's when he grabs her and starts wheeling her around that you kind of understand the structure of the shot now. And I loved that so much. I thought that was so good.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. And
why do you have another like an explanation of why that's so effective, or is it just kind of that subversion where you assume this is going to be a still tripod shot, and then it like, you know, they take you on this ride, or is there?
Well, part of the thing I liked about it was kind of what you were discussing, where as that shot opens, it's very static, right? And, you know, after about 10 seconds, 15 seconds, I'm like, oh, I hope it's attached to the wheelchair. And then we see her shake a little bit. And then I realized, oh, they are attached to the wheelchair. This is already a cool shot. And I know it's going to be getting cooler because there's no other reason to attach the camera to the wheelchair. But the thing I think that's interesting about that is that we're kind of getting, it's not like a point of view shot from Jay's perspective, but we're kind of
you're fixed to her.
Yeah, exactly. We're experiencing what Jay is experiencing, and especially in a movie like this that requires a scene with a lot of exposition, which is what this scene is. It picks the right focus point for that exposition. We don't care about what Hugh looks like when he's saying what this is. We care about Jay's reaction to it, and Jay's fearful reaction to everything that's going on around her is way more important than Hugh standing there and explaining what it is while looking around with his little flashlight.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to move on.
I think that is a moment of like pure exposition that really passes. Like, it doesn't seem like as much exposition because it's not just a shot of him talking. You know, we see her reacting. And, we said this isn't like exactly a point of view shot, but it is fixed very much on her position and her body and things like that. And of all horror movies, the ones where only one person can see what they're afraid of at a time normally, I think POV is so important. Obviously, Hugh and Jay are on the same page because they can see the same affliction. But the point of view is so important when Jay is just with her friends and she's with a bunch of people who can't see this thing. And so what you said before about like establishing these point of view shots, I think it's so vital to this movie, even more so than most horror movies.
Yeah, exactly. And in going with what we were discussing, as far as the camera looking Jay straight on, the scene later on where everybody's at the beach, and you know, everybody's sitting around in their lawn chairs, and the girl that loves licorice is out in the water, and the way that everybody is framed is is different from Jay. Everybody's framed kind of in what appears to be Jay's perspective, with the exception of maybe Greg, because I think her and Greg are sitting next to each other, and it would just, that angle of Greg wouldn't be possible for Jay to see. But the way her sister is lying on the ground, we see that from Jay's perspective. The way Paul is sitting, we see that from Jay's perspective. And then we cut to Jay, and the camera is facing her head on. It's not like the same, you know, she's not the exact same distance as she would have been in the wheelchair shot, but it's probably close. And she is just on a line with the camera and straight ahead. And it just sort of shows that, further shows that we are just tied into this perspective, this point of view, even when we're not seeing her point of view. You know, like, this is the focus, is Jay. We're supposed to care about Jay or be concerned with her troubles.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Do you like the title?
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Okay.
You do, right?
Yeah, I've been recommending this movie to people for, like, you know, since I saw it. Heard of it, plus kind of a very vague title lately. I think it's wonderful. I think it's great for the reasons we discussed, of this having a totally believable, very basic reading, and but also having so many other things to it. And I just think that there is a lot of stuff in here about growing up and coming of age that isn't necessarily tied to sexuality 100%, but that this movie really does a good job of exploring.
Well, and I think the fact that Jay isn't a virgin at the beginning of this movie is
I love that.
Oh, of course you do, because it's great, because it's a smart decision. It's really great. And
why is it so smart, though?
Because then it just be, I don't know, it just, it's, then she's a 19-year-old that hasn't had sex, which is uncommon in film.
Who looks like that?
Baby Gwen Stefani.
For me, it's Keira Knightley head on and side with none of the charisma.
Sorry, I missed the second one.
late era Brittany Murphy from the side with none of the charisma.
You always got to inject beam into things, don't you? Yeah, and it's just another way that this movie kind of breaks from teen movie conventions, is that in most teen movies that are even kind of about sex, then the character or one of the main characters is, or one of the main focuses of the movie is always a virgin, and there's a lot of focus on that person losing their virginity, and that's the big moment. And that's definitely not the big moment of It Follows. And I think that allows It Follows to focus on different things, and it allows it to, even just for the fact that it makes it look like a more thoughtful movie, because it's a movie that's conscious of all other teen movies that have come before it, or movies about teenagers that have come before it, and it's able to make the coming of age less sexual and therefore more interesting. You know what I mean?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Even horror movies that aren't about sex or are much significantly less about sex than this movie, which, you know, even if we're saying maybe the most interesting reading isn't about sex, it's undeniably about sex just in the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those movies, like, you know, all the Friday the 13th and thing like that, which I would say aren't really as much about sex as this are, everything's set in motion because someone went to lose their virginity, or someone went to smoke weed the first time or something like that. And this totally moves around.
Yeah. Yep.
Said, because she's not a virgin at the start, we can't just take the kind of puritanical reading of, like, you have sex, you die, you do drugs, you die. You know, she's had sex. She's kind of over it, I guess, like, not 100%, but she's, you know, still, it's not like we're catching up with her, and this is the big struggle of where she is right now. And I think it's, you know, so many of the other things that, again, kind of come a bit with sex, but more with just kind of growing up. And it's, yeah, like, a lot of them are tied to sex, but it's just this idea that, like, sex isn't going to solve all the problems of adolescence. And there's all these kind of sexual anxieties that aren't about sexually transmitted diseases. Like, oh, is this person having sex with me because they have some ulterior motive? Or is this person having sex with me because they just want like the self-satisfaction and like, I don't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of stuff is the more interesting elements that are still very much related to sex, but not just, you know, premarital sex bad, marriage sex good. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like there's this anxiety about, you know, not wanting to be just another one of used up tissues on top of those porn magazine piles. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, just not wanting that to be kind of a victim of someone else's personal gratification. And I think that extends to relationships. I think, you know, you don't want to be someone who's just in it to keep that other person company or to support them. And again, it is kind of all wrapped up in sex, but I think it's there's a ton of more interesting things with sex that's tangential to the main point.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then we get kind of some of these fears after the fact, and about relationships too, and not just sex. And after she and Greg have sex, there is this kind of mistrust in the group that like he had sex with someone else and in some way kind of cheated, because he wasn't having the problem with the you know, this entity, this it, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of that apprehension of like someone cheating on you or someone moving on quickly. And, you know, I think that gets tied into this idea of, you know, the way that you get rid of this curse is to have sex with someone else. Like, the way to get over heartbreak is to, you know, do the rebound kind of thing. Like, I think there's a lot of interesting relationship ideas in here that aren't as tied up into sex as I think a lot of people's initial readings of this movie are.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah, and just going back to the the, you know, difference between youth and adulthood that it's discussed so much in this movie. I really enjoy the scene at the movie theater where Hugh and Jay are playing that game. I forget what Jay calls it.
She calls it the trade game.
Yes. Okay.
A people watching game. Colin, a people watching game.
Peter Jackson's trade game. The official game of the movie. Or of the people watching game. But yeah, I really enjoy it's mostly in retrospect after you see the rest of the movie that this scene really is interesting. But when he's talking about how he wants to know what it's like to not have made mistakes and have his whole life ahead of you, and he says, look how happy that kid is, you know, and they put the button on it of him saying he could take a shit whenever he wants, you know.
One of the few funny parts of this movie.
Oh, and all of them seem to involve Hugh. When that girl is walking by, that part's really funny.
Well, that's a good joke that I was kind of waiting to happen because the nature of like the curse. Of-
yeah.
Right after he's like, "You got to get the fuck out of my house." Like, for some reason, that was really funny to me too.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I think in retrospect that that's pretty interesting, especially since he's 21 and it's my understanding that Jay's 19, and she points out, she's like, you're only 21, like, you're not old, you know that, right? Yeah. And even at that age, he knows that there are some things that he'll never be able to undo and some things that will always kind of be with him. And he's gotten smart enough to learn these things and then smart enough to learn that these things are bad and then smart enough to learn that they will continue to haunt him for the rest of his life. And he wants that promise, or sorry, not that promise, but the potential to be able to not have those things. Like, he wants to be able to go back to being a kid with good parenting, by the way, but people just caring for him and the potential to not screw up in the, I guess, 18 years that come between then and being 21. I don't know how old that kid was. But.
Yeah, and I mean, she guesses he wants to be the guy talking to the good-looking female. And
yeah,
that
exactly.
is so far from his from where he is in life right now, right? And,
yeah.
Like, he just sees that as more chances of regret and more problems and things like that.
And then when they leave the theater, because of the it that follows him and the it that he wants to remove from his life.
Yeah, I don't think this movie really falls apart near the end, but I think this movie comes out really, really strong. I think that first scene, Annie, whatever, the girl running in heels.
Yes, it's Annie.
The girl who...
that's the one name I can remember.
Yeah, I know. Yara's gone. Kelly even left your brain somehow. Anyway. Yeah.
I like Kelly. I like that actress. I want her to be in more things. There's something likable about her.
But Annie kind of... stumbling around in the heels, showing she is a teenager. Quite ready for it, in my opinion.
Sorry, what'd you say?
A teenager looking to be an adult and not quite ready for it, in my opinion,
yeah.
Which is how I read anyone in a movie running around with heels on.
It certainly seems like she just put on the first pair of shoes that she could find. Like, she was trying to get out of the house and knew she needed shoes, and maybe those heels were there.
I think you're better off with no shoes than heels.
That's probably true.
Yeah, well, anyway, but yeah, that scene of her, and then, you know, she drives to the beach, and it, like, that's pretty much as gory as we get when we see her with her, you know, legs broken open and the blood in her leg, like, entirely spun around. You know, I think that just sets, and it's such a mystery what this menace is. A little bit of a Jaws throwback, I thought, too. Unseen mm-hmm. killer, girl on the beach.
Yeah.
I like that we kind of start off with, like, pretty much the worst violence and the, like, we see the power and the fear that this thing can cause, but we have no idea what it is. And then, like, and that's how we get into this movie. And also, like, shortly after that, we see those kids peeking over the bushes at Jamie in the pool. And right away, we get, like, the degree of how powerful this thing is. And then this huge question mark that we could use to explain everything throughout the, like, what happens to Jamie's house for the rest of this movie, like, any broken window, any bouncing ball, like, anything just could have been these kids. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's something I really like about, they just demonstrate, like, the power of this creature, put a huge question mark on it, and then kind of let the movie play out. I thought that was a really, really strong intro.
Yeah, for sure. I would agree.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about Detroit at all?
Detroit what? Sure. I suppose you can go first.
Well, Detroit, where were the parents at?
It's whatever time of the day it is. Do you know where your kids are? The answer is no.
Yeah. No, I just like the kind of this idea of, like, a whole city that, you know, unfortunately might be past its prime. I would love to see Detroit come back and not be in the terrible state that it is in. But I think kind of just tying up with this this idea of kind of adolescence being a certain point and never really being able to go back to this better time, and just what a terrible state Detroit's in, like, totally played into so many of the themes of this movie. You know, it's just the city on the downswing and just so much violence and things like that. And the one house that they go in, Hugh's house.
Yeah.
It's a style called American Foursquare, where it's basically, like, that circular setup where you could go, like, kitchen, living room, bedroom, and, like, go in a perfect circle without ever really reversing.
Yeah.
And those exist a lot in Detroit, and it's, you know, the perfect house if you're living with it following you, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's none of these rooms have just one exit, and I thought that was really good too. Mm-hmm. And then one more with the sexual reading of this. It's when they're going back to the pool,
mm-hmm.
like the main pool where Paul and Jimmy had their first kiss and where they try to take down it. She's described, I think it's Yara's describing her experience, and says, I was never allowed to go south of 8 Mile Road. And, you know, that's where the suburbs end and the city starts. And, you know, to make a crude diagram of the body, we'll call 8 Mile Road your waist.
Yeah.
And, you know, she even says, like, I didn't even know what that meant. Like, it is this kind of sexual metaphor. There's something behind it that she didn't quite understand. And, you know, I think it just aligned so many of the sexual themes with this movie. And that was something I can't really think of, but was pretty effective.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And it's just kind of, it's also about, you know, like, what they're doing is now going to the city. They're crossing 8 Mile without parents, you know, even removing from the sexual idea entirely. You know, they've spent all of their time in the suburbs, and now they have to go to where the city starts, but they have to do so without guidance now. And it's basically like they're crossing the line of adulthood, even in a non-sexual way. They are leaving the world they were raised in, and they need to be aware of the dangers that are across that line, but they also have to go across that line.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, their initial instinct is kind of like they revert, you know what I mean? They're in the suburbs, things go poorly. They go, you know, I think north, or they go to a more rural area, you know, they go to that hunting lodge or whatever of Greg's dad.
Yeah.
you know, it's kind of like reverting into childhood, as, you know, a lot of literature, like the open fields, the rural areas, the more idyllic, you know, more Eden kind of area. The suburbs would be kind of a middle ground. And then the city is adulthood, the real world and things like that. And so, you know, they try to revert. They try to go back. There's some, all the pool womb imagery, I think, is not something I'm the first one to notice. you know, they try to revert and then they realize, like, kind of there is no going back. We have to cross 8 Mile. We have to kind of grow up. We have to face the city, face these adult fears and adult issues, and then try to overcome them there.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you, you kind of laughed about the water one. You don't see the water as a symbol in this movie?
No, it definitely is. And the backyard pool becoming broken, I think, is a notable thing as well, right?
What's your take on that?
Oh, you have to go out of your backyard. It ties into the 8 Mile speech, right? You have to leave your backyard to go to this bigger pool because you have to eventually leave the comfortable home that you're in. You know, regardless of the level of comfort, I think the pool in your backyard is still more comfortable than the public pool across 8 Mile. You know?
Yeah, I would say so, judging by that. do you put any significance to the fact it's immediately after that scene where she presumably swims out to the boat? Slash, what's your take on that boat scene? Slash, did she fuck all those three dudes on a boat?
I think one. Yeah, I think that one's pretty clear. I don't know the total count, but
well, okay, yeah, that's less important.
Yeah.
So what's the connection there?
I don't know. I think it's just sort of like the place we are introduced to her. She ends up having to leave through no choice of her own. I guess you could certainly tie in birth to that. The birth of her as an adult that can no longer swim in this background pool of a womb. But yeah, I don't have a strong reading on it. And the place she then goes to swim is obviously much larger and much less contained.
You know? Yeah, it's, I don't know.
It has undertow potentially.
Yeah, that the water thing's interesting to me because it seems to kind of go both ways. And then I don't think that's a fault in the visuals of this movie. It just seems like water can be good and bad. Like, I think when she swims out to those boaters and has sex with one to three of them, you know, that you said that's kind of like, that's the more dangerous one. And that seems to empty out, you know, her backyard pool for whatever visual that is. Like, it's the seems like the safety, as you were saying, like the backyard is gone. I think, like that kind of backyard pool feeling is gone. I think of a bit of her self-respect is gone at that point, because I think that was the first time she had sex with someone just to get rid of this thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when she has sex with Hugh, she just wants to have sex with Hugh. When she has sex with Paul, it's kind of a bit of an experiment, and she's had sex with Paul before. Oh, sorry, not Paul, Greg. Yeah, it's kind of an experiment, and she's had sex with Greg before. Like, it wasn't a big deal. They did it already in high school or a few years ago, whatever. It wasn't a big deal. And, you know, that seems to kind of dry up this backyard pool. And, like, when she has sex with these strangers, I think that's, like, a big change for her, and that is a significant kind of point of no return. And when she has sex with Paul near the end of the movie, we look out that window and we get rain. And, you know, we get kind of water again, and it's this comforting womb, mm-hmm. kind of a regenerative, very positive image in, you know, all kinds of media. So she has sex with Paul, and I think that was like a genuine one that she does kind of out of affection for Paul this time. Like, it's kind of it's one of the first times we see her have sex, and it's, you know, for what I would say are probably the right reasons. You know, and then that causes the rain to fall. It's not as much to fill a pool, but it's some. And it's kind of that idea that there are good and bad things that come with growing up. And it's never, you're never going to be able to find as many good things to get you back to that perfect womb state. But you're going to get enough to survive. You're going to get enough to be happy. You're going to get enough to walk down the street with someone you care about, even if you're not as happy as the children playing beside you, and you're not quite at the point of the old man raking death off the ground, there is kind of that middle ground that you can occupy to the best of your ability, and life is trying to fight hard enough to make that part enjoyable.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Man, and check back next week when we'll be talking about Ex Machina. All right. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.